Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is an encore presentation of The Brian Lehrer Show. Don't even think about calling in. Well, my first guest this hour writes that she fulfilled her lifelong ambition by the time she was 22 years old. So given the fact that she just celebrated her 66th birthday a couple of days ago, she's had time to come up with a few other dreams, and guess what? She's fulfilled them as well. Nora Ephron's first career was as a journalist at the New York Post, but she's written magazine articles and novels. She wrote the screenplays for When Harry Met Sally, Silkwood, and Sleepless in Seattle, which she directed. Her latest book, I Feel Bad About My Neck and Other Thoughts on Being a Woman, is a bestseller. She just started a stint as a guest op-ed columnist at the New York Times and blogs at Huffington Post. So welcome back to WNYC, Nora Ephron.
Thank you, Brian.
You've been pretty vocal about not celebrating getting older. So is happy birthday not the right thing to say?
Oh, no, happy birthday at a certain point. Oh, my God, please say it. Thank you.
Happy birthday. Tell us for a minute about the title of your book. I know we've been through this before, but I feel bad about my neck. I'm guessing your neck has come in for an inordinate amount of scrutiny since the book came out.
I know. I feel almost obligated to wear turtlenecks and scarves at all times just to keep the thing going.
Any regrets?
Any regrets what?
About the title?
Oh, no. I actually think that the title, sometimes people say to me, why do you think this book has done so well? A question that probably implies that they thought it wouldn't do well, but I think it's mostly because of the title because I think that women look at that title and they think, oh yes, there it is in a nutshell, because that to me really is, you know, your neck. I don't want to get carried away about your neck, because your neck isn't really the point, but it is sort of the canary in the mine. It is the moment when you know that you are getting older, no matter how much you can do in terms of smiling really hard at yourself in the mirror so that some of the worst things go away.
Yeah.
Your neck is just there to tell you that there's just so much you can do.
So this book with this title has been a big hit and kind of goes against the grain in saying, you know, the current thinking that aging doesn't matter, that 60 is the new 30. Do you think you found an untapped market?
Well, I think that whenever you say something that rings a bell or tells the truth when everyone else has been telling a lie, you can find people who are willing to read it. And I've had this kind of unbelievably endless experience with the foreign publishers of it, because they would write me and say, you know, it's very hard to translate this title, and so we're calling it, and then they would send this title and they would say, which translates to, my wrinkles have wrinkles.
Mm.
And I would say, no, it has to translate to, I feel bad about my neck. There must be some way to say this in Swedish or Portuguese or whatever language it is. And it's been this struggle to make them understand that title is the thing. However,
do you think that women are more critical of other women's appearances? I noticed in your blog that you've taken issue with Katie Couric's makeup, Nancy Pelosi's haircut, and frankly I was shocked to read the first line of your entry about meeting Condoleezza Rice, which was how much prettier she is in person. If I wrote that, you know, I'd get kicked off the air.
Well, I'm not sure that's true. I don't think you would get kicked off the air for saying that Condoleezza Rice was prettier in person than she seemed.
Maybe for leading with it.
Well, I don't know, because it isn't all that I wrote, you know. It's just something to get people to. But I think that there's some truth to that. I think I think that women do notice those things, but I also notice that that people are writing a huge amount about Al Gore's weight and how old John McCain looks, and that physical appearance is a factor in this campaign, and how, and by the way, how good Mitt Romney looks, by the way, how much he, quote, looks like a president, which is thought to be a factor in why he's doing so well. It certainly explains some of it to me, because what's coming out of his mouth doesn't.
Which I guess brings us to one of your fellow Wellesley grads who is in politics in a big way, Hillary Clinton. She graduated just a few years after you, but from things you've written, it sounds like there were big cultural changes for women in just those years at the school, yes?
No question. I think our class at Wellesley, the class of 1962, we were just before everything happened. And I remember at one of my class reunions, one of my classmates got up and said this heartbreaking sentence, which was, "Our education was a dress rehearsal for a life we never led." Isn't that wow, right?
Right, because everything changed after the 60s started sometime after that.
Yes, the 60s started when? In about 65 or 6, right? I mean, when I was in college, there were sit-ins. The civil rights movement was just beginning, but just barely. But most everyone I went to college with pretty much knew that we were, you know, if you were interested in medicine, you were supposed to marry a doctor. That's how it was going to work, even if you went to a place like Wellesley. And then when Hillary Clinton graduated, it was a very different world. She went to law school in a period when a lot of young women knew that they were going to go to law school. And it was only 6 years difference.
We had journalist Jack Hitt on the show a couple of weeks ago, and his theory in Mother Jones about why Hillary Clinton is such a polarizing figure is that we haven't figured out what women should be in all those years since Hillary's valedictory speech at her graduation. By graduating earlier, do you feel you missed out or dodged a bullet?
Well, I don't feel that I missed out, because I think... Well, first of all, I think I probably would have missed out in some deep way whenever, assuming that we can defy all the rules of, you know, would I have been a different person, blah, 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 blah. But I was sort of hell-bent on being a journalist. And if you're a journalist, you kind of miss out on a certain amount of this stuff anyway, because you're not in it, you're watching it. But I think that, so I don't, you know,
did
I don't
you read,
know.
Did you read?
I don't know.
Go ahead.
I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah.
It's a tricky, it's one of those tricky questions, you know.
I wonder if you read Hitt's article or have this, you know, any lingering thoughts about the expectations that people have of Hillary Clinton and how she's a Rorschach test for people's whatevers. Because you've been very critical of her and even...
Oh, I think she's a complete Rorschach. And by the way, I don't think that people don't know what women ought to be. I think that everyone knows what women ought to be. It's just different, and they project it onto her. I mean, if you look at the way people responded to Hillary after the Monica Lewinsky episode. Everyone, you know, there were all sorts of people who thought she should have left her husband because they would have. And then there were people who thought it was great she stayed with her husband because they would have.
Yeah.
I mean, she is just it. And, you know, years and years ago, I think even right after she became First Lady, I think, I saw a little ad in a newspaper like the Village Voice that said, "If you have been having dreams about Hillary Clinton, I'm writing a paper about something or other." And I realized that I had been having dreams about Hillary Clinton.
Huh.
And that obviously I was not the only one, because here was this little little thing in the newspaper. And that was the moment I realized that she had become this sort of primal figure for people, certainly for me and for lots of other human beings. She just represents, people want her to do whatever they think they would do. And when she doesn't, they get very upset about it.
Nora Ephron is my guest on WNYC. And now Michelle Obama is taking some of the same heat that Hillary Clinton did as a campaign spouse. And from women, did you read Maureen Dowd's column taking her to task for undercutting her husband?
Well, you know, I did read that. Of course, I read everything Maureen Dowd writes. Is she taking heat for it?
Well, there seemed to be a hint of that in that column, but it's the same kind of scrutiny. You know, what kind of wife is acceptable when your husband is running for president?
Well, that's the game that they're all in now, you know. And by the way, we only have one man involved in that thing, but he's coming under a lot of scrutiny, too. I mean, this is the world now. Everybody comes under scrutiny. And I have a friend who received the other night an unbelievably tiny honor from an unbelievably small number of human beings in a not very big room. And he was worried about what he was going to say in his acceptance speech for fear someone in the room was going to take a picture of it with his cell phone and put it on a website when he isn't even particularly famous.
So is that lack of privacy or is that transparency, which is a good thing?
Well, I think transparency is a highly overrated thing, and I wish we would go back to a little bit of opaqueness. If opaqueness is the opposite of transparency, is it?
Maybe. Cindy,
I don't know. I'm always worried about my use of the word.
It is in window shades. I don't know if it is in politics.
Well, then it may be.
Cindy in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Nora Ephron.
Yes. I'm going to ask Nora about the idea that she's promoting ageism with the title of her book. It's bad enough that women are, singled out for their looks constantly, have been. It's part of art history. And our history, and now we are going to be focusing again on aging women to be ashamed of themselves, to be afraid to walk around with their necks showing. I mean, why don't we glorify older women instead of denigrating them?
Well, I actually think that one of the worst things that happened about 10 or 15 years ago was pretending that getting older was a thing that we were all supposed to feel cheerful and peppy about all the time, that it became this kind of thing that people became boosters about. And I don't think that I'm, quote, glorifying ageism at all. I'm just trying to tell the truth.
No, you're not glorifying it.
You said I was promoting ageism. But I'm not promoting ageism at all. I'm just trying to write about what it's actually like emotionally and psychologically to know that you are older. And what I really hope and what I feel has happened, and not just because of my book, but a little tiny bit because of it, is that people are much more open and funny and realistic about what it means to be older, instead of denying that there's anything different about it. I mean, there are realities about being older. And I think if we get them out there, we'll all just feel better about it. I think being truthful about the realities of getting older is not a question of promoting ageism. I just think it's about time. You know, I spent quite a few years reading books that just had no... or looking at books. I wouldn't say that I read them, but I did look at quite a few books that glorified getting older in a way that just did not seem to have any relationship to what the reality of it was. And I'm not merely talking about the grimmest reality, which is that people get sick and die. although that is one of the realities. But just all the things that happen to you when you get older, and some of them would be funny if they weren't so, you know, I mean, this thing everyone always says to you, which is, oh, it's great when you're older because you have more time to read and blah, 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 blah. But, of course, you can't find your glasses because you can't see them. And when you find the book, you discover your prescription has changed since yesterday, by the way. And, you know, all of that stuff is stuff that, it seems to me, if we can just get it out there, we won't all be so ashamed of being older. We'll be dealing with it in a realistic way.
Nora Ephron, my guest on WNYC. Her latest book is called I Feel Bad About My Neck. We'll continue in a minute talking more about her guest columnist stint at the New York Times. She's also blogging on Huffington Post, and we'll get into some more of the political stuff that she's been writing about. By the way, you know how you asked whether opaqueness is better than transparency?
Is the opposite of it.
Here's our listeners' response to that. Two quick emails that came in that say, it's opacity, not opaqueness.
Oh,
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We'll continue in a minute.
I'll never say it again.
Brian Lehrer at WNYC with the writer Nora Ephron. So your appearance here on the show came about today because you have started writing some guest columns for the New York Times. You had that one on Scrabble Blitz, which I guess was your inaugural column. How much will you be writing for them?
Well, that is something we don't know, but I would say about once a month. That's what I'm supposed to do.
And what's it like being back in the newspaper world since your days at the New York Post?
It doesn't feel like I'm exactly back in the newspaper world, since in my days at the New York Post, you actually had to go to an office to be in the newspaper world. And now you don't seem to have to go anywhere to do anything.
No, you just have to go to a high-speed internet connection.
Right.
And you also blog at Huffington Post, speaking of that. How different is a blog from an op-ed column?
Well, I think that one of the most interesting things I found when I started blogging is that it's sort of like email. When we started emailing, we sort of thought that emails were like letters and that they bore some resemblance to a form we understood. And so when we all started emailing, I can't speak for you, Brian, but I can certainly speak for myself. We all said things like dear so-and-so at the top, and we actually signed the bottom.
Yes, we've dispensed with all that now.
Yes, we actually said, how are you? And we thought it was supposed to be polite. And now we're sort of down to yes, no, maybe, I don't know. Or call me, because call me is I've discovered lately, especially, that the easiest way to do things is not in an email, but just on the phone.
But call me is a dangerous thing to write in an email, because it implies a commitment that email is supposed to avoid, actually having the conversation with somebody over a period of time.
I know, but have you ever tried to make a simple date for lunch or dinner by email? You cannot do it.
You can see the thread, and you've got 25 emails back and forth.
I know. It's amazing how long it takes to agree on a time in a restaurant and a day.
So you I'm sorry.
Whereas one phone call does that.
So you blog about...
But anyway, here's my point, is that
yes,
blogging, when I first thought about blogging or heard about it, I thought, oh, it's kind of like writing a column. But the truth is that a blog is way more ephemeral than even a daily newspaper column. It's sort of like a soap bubble. And what I didn't realize about it is that you should write them quickly, you should get them out there, and understand that the purpose of them is not for them to live for very long, but to be sort of pricked by other people. Do you know what I mean? A blog is kind of the beginning of a conversation.
Right. It's to be commented on, and that's the nature of the beast.
Yes, exactly. And So it's been kind of interesting because it's sort of like learning to speak a slightly different writing language. And I enjoy doing it.
That's good, right? Because it takes these columnists out of their ivory towers, whoever also dares to blog, and makes them mix it up with real people?
Well, I think it's all good. I think it's truly what's meant by interactivity. It really is something that is in some organic way a part of the media that it is functioning on.
So here's an email that just came in for you, and it says, how come she keeps saying growing older and not growing old? Everybody is growing older. She's talking about getting old, but cannot verbalize it without the suffix. Do you still feel so good about taking comments?
Oh, well, that's certainly a note I'll take. I'll take that note.
Yeah, okay.
I'll never say opaqueness again, and I'll never say older unless it's right.
So you blog about politics on Huffington Post, which is, an edgy political site, and you finally get this guest column spot in the New York Times, the vaunted New York Times, and what do you write about? Online Scrabble.
Well, I thought it would be a nice, easy way to begin. When I write on the Times op-ed page, I tend to write about lifestyle more than politics. I mean, I wrote an entire piece about cabbage strudel for the New York Times, so it's not like I think of the New York Times as this place where I'm now going to write, quote, important, unquote, articles.
Yeah, when I had an op-ed piece on the Times, it was about street fairs, so, you know.
Well, there it is.
I hear you.
But I actually think that what I was writing about, my addiction to online Scrabble, and particularly to an unbelievably dreadful form of it called Scrabble Blitz. But what I really was writing about was something that I think is a fairly serious thing, which is that I do think that the internet, that our addiction to computers is changing the way our brains work. And I feel it most acutely when I become addicted to something online, which I do every so often. And I think you can actually feel your brain sort of starting to fry between your ears. You can feel it turning to some sort of soggy, mushy thing as you keep hitting that button to play just one more game or whatever it is that you've gotten hooked on. And I absolutely believe that these kids growing up clicking, 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 clicking away, become more distractible, because I become more distractible. I think that part of this epidemic of ADD that we're seeing in kids is being reinforced and tipped over the border by this machine that we are all hooked on. And it is unbelievable to me to see. I mean, my sister Delia years ago mentioned to me that it was interesting to her that at night she would come home and instead of saying hello to her loved one, she would go to her computer, sit down, and answer a lot of mail from people she barely knew. I mean, it's this instinctive thing. You walk into your house and you sit down in the chair in front of that computer and start clicking away.
Let me get back to politics, because besides Nancy Pelosi's haircut and the gap in Condoleezza Rice's teeth, you've blogged about George Tenet and...
Well, I know, but I really did write about Nancy Pelosi and Condoleezza Rice.
I know, but there it is.
I just want to say that.
But you blogged about Tenet and Guantanamo Bay. You also said recently you were being naive to expect anyone to resign on principle, and said no one resigns on principle. Paul Wolfowitz just resigned, although hardly on principle.
Hardly on principle. Well, it turns out that John Ashcroft almost resigned on principle.
Oh, over the wiretapping?
Yes, and one longs to know exactly what was in that piece of paper that was so egregious that even John Ashcroft was willing to resign over it. I mean,
in his hospital
bed. At some
point,
I hope we find that out.
Jim,
I hope we don't have to wait too long to find out what it was that caused John Ashcroft to have that moment.
It's true, because we know it had something to do with the warrantless wiretapping program, but nobody has said what exactly.
I mean, Ashcroft was in favor of torture, so what could have been in this bill? I cannot wait to find out.
Jim?
And I'm heartbroken, by the way, that story of James Comey having to rush to Ashcroft's hospital room to protect him from the president's chief of staff and the president's legal counsel. I'm heartbroken that story seems to have died in the week from when it first came out.
Maybe that's why the immigration compromise got reached. Jim in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, I wanted to bring up since you guys talked about Wolfowitz, I wanted to actually talk about Shahar Reza. When you look at her background, this is clearly an amazing woman who's been with the World Bank since 1997.
This is Wolfowitz, what we used to call girlfriend, what the Times keeps calling partner or companion.
The partner, and this woman is, like, if you look at her background, I mean, she, you know, every woman and feminist out there should admire this woman because of all the work that she's done. And yet, look at the New York Times, and they use the term girlfriend or mistress.
The New York Times did not use that word to describe her.
No, they haven't said mistress. And I don't think they've said girlfriend. I think they've said partner and companion. And I guess if there's a reason for that, as a writer, have you thought about this, Nora? The only thing I can figure is that it's to be sexual orientation neutral. So that if, you know, a man has a male partner or a woman has a female partner, then they're not using a different word or they don't have to identify the gender of that person and out them thereby. So when it comes up in a case like this, they just say companion. Is that why?
I don't know, but it's definitely an incentive for marriage, it seems to me, because if I were ever identified as someone's companion, I would definitely want to get married just to get rid of that name. Girlfriend, I guess you can't use because of the word girl, right? Because girl is sort of, it sounds too 18 years old or something.
Yeah,
or
well, women use girl with three R's as a badge of honor and, you know, talk about their friends as their girlfriends. But on Jim's point about her, if Wolfowitz wasn't a political target, then this woman would be a feminist hero for the work she's doing in the Third World.
Well, I have no idea. I'd never heard of her before, but I don't think she seems like a perfectly competent human being, but I have no opinion on her at all. I don't know anything about her except what I read in the last month or so since all of this came to light. But I'm perfectly willing to take Jim's word for it that that's what she should be. I don't know.
You want to go back to James Comey, who was acting attorney general while Ashcroft was sick, protecting Ashcroft from the president? I know about that. You know about that. But probably a lot of listeners heard that and thought, protecting the attorney general of the United States from his boss, the president of the United States. What happened there?
Well, what seems to have happened there was that the Justice Department and John Ashcroft told the president that they would not approve an extension of the warrantless wiretapping bill. And at that very moment, Ashcroft was felled by a bout of pancreatitis, put into a hospital, and had his gallbladder removed. And he had meanwhile appointed James Comey to be acting attorney general. And Comey refused to sign this bill that the White House, the extension of this program, it wasn't a bill, that the White House knew that Ashcroft and the Justice Department were opposed to. And someone in the White House decided that they would send Andrew Card and Alberto Gonzalez to the hospital where Ashcroft was within 24 hours of having had his gallbladder removed. Is this going to be called gallbladder gate? I don't know. But to send them to the hospital in the hopes that, he would be too groggy to remember that only 48 hours earlier he had been opposed to it, and they could get him to sign this thing. And when James Comey found out that they were on the way there, he ordered his drivers, I'm not exaggerating here, he ordered his drivers to speed to the hospital. He actually called the head of the FBI and asked him to speak to the FBI men in the room with Ashcroft to tell them not to allow Andrew Card to throw him, James Comey, the acting attorney general, out of the room. I mean, the implication that the Justice Department believed that they were dealing with, there's no other word for it but thugs. The reaction to this, which is not that we're all civilized, finishing stuff. And later in the evening, after John Ashcroft amazingly rose himself up in his hospital bed and refused to extend the program and informed Andrew Card that in any case he was not the attorney general, the attorney general was James Comey, Comey left and was ordered by Andrew Card to appear at the White House immediately, ASAP, and Comey said to Andrew Card, I will not appear in the White House and meet with you without a witness. And I want that witness to be the Solicitor General of the United States, Ted Olson. I mean, this is an episode that is just jaw-dropping in terms of the what it says about who the Justice Department thought the White House was.
I'm glad I gave you that little platform there.
Well, I'm mesmerized by this episode because, of course, I remember Watergate, and it has such an air of Watergate about it. And part of what I mean by it is that there was a period before we began to hear what was on those tapes when one could not imagine the dialogue. One could not imagine the unbelievably low level to which this White House had sunk. And that, I think, is what we got a glimpse of.
We're almost out of time, but you mentioned remembering Watergate. Now, you were married to Carl Bernstein once upon a time, but you've been credited with having guessed correctly who Deep Throat was. He didn't tell you?
He wouldn't have told me because I would have told everybody, including you, on the air had you asked me at any time, if we had been just having a conversation like this and you'd said to me who is Deep Throat, I would have been happy to tell you it was Mark Felt. I would also have been happy to tell you that Carl certainly didn't tell me because I just can't keep a secret.
That's now we know why that marriage didn't last, I guess.
That's certainly one of the many reasons.
So just to finish up with a couple of emails that have come in the last few minutes, somebody wanted us to know that Wolfowitz not only lost his job, lost his girlfriend, according to an article on Think Progress, which says that he and Risa have split up. Risa was reportedly upset by all the publicity and the implication that she was getting ahead with the help of a powerful man, says that website. And
but she kept the money.
Maybe she kept the money and the job. And the, let's see, and someone else writes, that the New York Times did once call her his girlfriend, as documented on Slate. And finally, how about this one? Subject line, opaqueness is correct.
Oh, thank you, whoever you are.
Dictionary.com credits opaqueness or opacity as the adjective. So there you go. Nora Ephron's latest book is I Feel Bad About My Neck and Other Thoughts on Being a Woman. She writes op-eds about life on the New York Times editorial page as a guest op-ed columnist. She blogs about politics on Huffington Post. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you so much, Brian.